Dublin's Talking Sport.
Welcome to Dublin's Talking Sports podcast with me, Ken Doherty, and my good friend, Reggie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in to catch up on the latest GAA, football, rugby, and all the crack. Enjoy the show, and don't forget, rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Another great show today here on Dublin's Talking Sport. I caught up with Ken, who gave us his view on the Masters and his prediction on who he thinks might win it. Stephen O'Brien of the UK Packers also joined me as we get down to the business end of things in the NFL with the playoffs, and he gives his prediction on who he thinks might be lifting the trophy at the end of the season in Super Bowl. In rugby, we spoke to Will Slattery of the Left Wing podcast and caught up with him on all things Champions Cup. Great win for Munster last night, but still plenty of games in store, and Leinster challenging the EPCR with their view that the game was unfair for them to be cancelled. Declan Drake gives another full packed rundown on all things that are happening in the GAA throughout the county, and Alan Cawley winds things up for us with a great review on all of the football for this week. So as always, have a listen to us on all of the places where you find your podcasts.
Good morning, Reg. Okay, all good. How are you?
Yeah, all great. yeah, it's been an interesting week sport-wise, no question about it. But I've been watching the Masters. I can't remember a time, I'll be honest with you, when snooker has been sort of back up there as one of the go-to sports in the way that it has. It's amazing. It's fantastic to see. But a bit of a surprise result last night with Selby getting beaten by Hawkins.
Yeah, big surprise. World number one out. He was, you know, big favourite to beat Barry Hogan. Barry Hogan's a very steady player, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, and he's had some good runs in the World Championship, three semi-finals and a final. Lost in the final here to Ronnie O'Sullivan a few years ago. But I always thought that he'd push Selby, but I didn't think he'd play so well. And Selby was just very, very poor. You know, 6-1 it was in the end. And it was probably just as well, because it finished 6-1. But if it had gone anywhere near 6-5, they might have been there till midnight. So I think a lot of people were sort of delighted it went 6-1 even in the end, you know, because it was a little bit drawn out. But the rest, as you said, the rest of the snooker from day one here at the Masters has been absolutely incredible. The crowds, Reggie, they've never had a bigger crowd. O'Sullivan's match, a very first match against Lisowski, was the biggest crowd they've ever had. At the Masters, it was over 2,000 people, and the atmosphere, and particularly the John, I don't know whether you saw the John Higgins Mark Williams match, but everybody stood up for both players,
well,
and
it was
unbelievable. Yeah, the atmosphere and the welcome that the both players got, and they were solely taken back by it. I mean, I was taken back. I was walking in the studio, but the hairs in the back of my neck were standing up watching the two guys coming in. It was just sort of it was one of those situations. It was just an appreciation for both players of what they've done over the years, and still at the top and still playing great snooker. It was Williams eventually won 6-5 in the end, and what a match it was. Like, it was three centuries in it. It was great drama, great finish to it, and what they've done here to the Masters is just absolutely fantastic, you know.
You kind of feel like it's a little bit of pent up, you know, in the fans. They've been locked up and not allowed to enjoy sports.
Yeah.
That pent up frustration. They're just spilling out onto the
arena. Yeah, absolutely. It feels like that, because we weren't here last year. We were locked down in Milton Keynes. They were playing behind closed doors. There wasn't a sinner in the place. And it's sort of, and I tell you what, who has been a great influence, and I don't know whether you've noticed it or not, but the MC, Rob Walker, to get the crowd going beforehand, the build up, and just building up the players, and trying to get the crowd really sort of, you know, emotionally charged, as it were.
Let's hope it doesn't turn into the darts, though.
No. There'll be no, like, Sweet Caroline or like that, you know. It's been sensational, you know. And Ronnie went out, of course, to Neil Robertson. So it's Neil Robertson against Williams today, and Hawkins against Strud Trump tonight. Yeah, but I think it's been sold out. It's been sold out like the whole weekend. So it's been sold out since Wednesday.
Yeah.
And as I said, they've increased the capacity in the arena to over 2,000. Started off with 1,000, went up to 1,500 a few years ago. Now it's up to over 2,000. So it's brilliant, absolutely
amazing,
fantastic.
Amazing, obviously.
Yeah.
Their restrictions, not like here, but anyway, that's an interesting story. Yeah. What do you reckon? I mean, Mark Williams, they're all playing such great snooker. You'd have to fancy Judd Trump to take care of Barry Hawkins, but you wouldn't know after what Hawkins did. It feels like a Trump Williams final, or am I way off there?
No. I mean, the way Williams played against Higgins, it wouldn't surprise me if he turned over Neil Robertson. But I'll just sort of slightly favour Neil Robertson. I think he'll just score. He's a better long putter and a better scorer. And I think Trump will, as you said, dispose of Hawkins, I think, quite convincingly. And it'll be a Trump-Robertson or Trump-Williams final, I think, whichever one it may be, would be absolutely fantastic. You know, it'd be great TV. Particularly Trump Robertson, because these are the not young guns, but these are the guys who have taken over the sort of mantle from the likes of the class of 92 of Williams, Higgins, and O'Sullivan. Even though those guys are still at the top as well and still winning tournaments, but these other guys, the likes of Trump and Robertson, have been hot on their heels and been, you know, winning consistently. But I think it's going to be a great final, whoever's going to be there. And anyway, you know,
I remember meeting Trump with you about 6 or 7 years ago down in Cork.
Lovely fella.
But I remember the time you were saying to me, this guy is going to be world champion, this guy is going to be the best there is around, you know.
He
has kind of underachieved a little bit though for the talent, has he?
Underachieved. I know it's exactly what you mean. He hasn't won as many of these Triple Crown events as you would expect.
Yeah.
But he's won something like he won 6 tournaments in 20 out of 20. You know, over the last couple of years,
right.
He's won sort of 14 tournaments out of sort of 30, something like that. His strike ratio is incredible. You know, over the last couple. But you're right, I get what you're saying, because the Triple Crown events, the UK, the Masters and the World, he hasn't won enough of them, basically. He's won each of them, but he hasn't won enough of them. Like, O'Sullivan's won 20 of them,
right.
Hendry 19, you know. So that's the way that we sort of gauge him on the Triple Crown events. But he's won over 20-odd ranking tournaments.
That's not bad.
You
give him that song.
Yeah, but we've had a good week. I don't know whether you saw me doing the demos the other day.
Did you? I'll bring you down and show you how to break off if you want.
I gave it a big build up, you know, put the cue ball tight behind the cushion on the left hand side or the right hand side, behind the green or the yellow. And then what do? I break off and it goes in off. Anyway, I wouldn't mind, but the crowd had spilled out from the match and they're all gathering in the cue zone right behind me, you know.
Yeah.
And it was the biggest cheer I've had for a long, long time. I know that they absolutely loved it, you know.
That's what you want.
Yeah.
It was great.
And I could hear it. You know the way you wear the earpieces, you know, so you listen to the director, you know. Even the director and everybody in the truck, they burst out laughing, in my ear as well.
It was perfect.
I got some stick over it. I know that, but it was quite funny, you know.
It makes us all realize it happens to the best. There you go. We all know.
Live TV, Reg.
Yeah. I was going to say to you, the Djokovic thing is dragging on again a bit.
It is, isn't it?
I can't believe we're still talking about it a week later, but...
No, and it's tonight, I think, at 10:30 tonight. Even though he was sort of given permission, to play, and then of course Hawke, the Premier, revoked it. So he's back in court, and there's going to be another hearing tonight at 10:30. But I feel like that was the last straw. Once Hawke, I don't think Hawke could sort of afford to let him play, because I think he's going to fear there's going to be huge sort of a huge backlash. And there'll be like demonstrations, there'll be lots. I think Djokovic should just cut his ties and just go home.
I can't believe the stubbornness of him. I can't believe
the stubbornness of the man. Because even if he does play,
he's going to get, and how could he even play tennis? The Aussies are not quiet, and they'll be like the ones that are anti him being there. There'll be some that are pro him being there, but the ones that are anti him being there, they'll abuse him from start to finish.
Oh yeah, exactly. He'll get a terrible reception. I think he sort of tainted his sort of image and his career, but just by his stubbornness, you know. Yeah. And I think he shouldn't have even travelled there, because, you know, he's a very pro anti-vaxxer, and you know, he should have known what he was going to, and he should have just cut his tires and gone back home, you know, and said, okay, I understand your decision, I'll just go back home. And people would have said, yeah, well, fair play then, you know. But now, I think people would have lost a lot of respect for him, you know.
Yeah, I get you. All right, okay.
Yeah.
You're busy today then? You're going back in the commentary box?
Yeah, back in the com box for this afternoon's match, and then in the studio tonight for the second semi-final. The first semi-final, Robertson against Williams, and then the second one will be Trump against Hawkins, yeah.
Okay.
So it was good, though, but I'm enjoying it, I must say.
Give me a winner over.
I'm going to go, I'd like to see Williams in the final.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go Robertson 6-4, and I think Trump will win 6-2, 6-3.
There was a press conference earlier on during the week, and Firhouse native Owen Doyle was talking about his departure from Bolton and return to League of Ireland and his time in the UK. Let's have a quick listen to that.
It was a bit of a conversation between myself and the manager at the start, and he understood that I always wanted to come back here. He also said he didn't want me to leave as well, so it was just one of them where it was kind of like, he'll do what's best in my best interests. So obviously once I got the call and then I had that conversation with the gaffer at Bolton, things kind of started to move fairly quick, and honestly I can't thank them enough, Bolton, the way the exit happened and such. They made the transition very easy. The last year or so, you definitely feel the not the pressure, but the pain, I suppose, of playing 45, 50 games a year, Saturday, Tuesday. It can be very demanding. I love it now all the same, but you do feel the pain of it, like, eventually. And obviously going back, playing a few less games, I'm sure it'll help the body. When I played Rotherham in the last league game last week, I would have had a bit of a moment in the dressing room before the match. I would have had to take myself into the toilet just because I knew it was going to be the last league game I played. So it was good. I had a great decade, I suppose, over here. Plenty, done it all, really, like promotions, relegations, bought, sold, left out in the cold, brought in out of nowhere, all of it, like, I've experienced it all. So it's been some trip. I've really enjoyed it.
A very honest, open and frank conversation there with Owen Doyle. Delighted to be joined on the line by Alan Cawley to discuss it further. Morning, Al, how are you?
Going good, Reggie, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks, very good. I know you know Owen well, and you've had good conversations with him yourself in the past. An interesting press conference during the week, earlier in the week, where he was very honest and open, and I suppose kind of giving us a little bit of an insight into why he made the decision to come back, and playing less games and maybe giving his body more chance to recover seems to be quite up there on the list.
Yeah, like, if you speak to most or you listen to most football interviews, Reggie, a lot of them can be bland and boring. You certainly won't get that with Owen Doyle. It'd be like going down to have a pint with him in the pub, really. He'll tell you all sorts of stories and all sorts of carry on in terms of the insight from behind the scenes and what really goes on at a football club. So he's a great character. He's a great lad. He is very honest. And as he said himself in that little piece there, he has experienced it all. Like, he's had a brilliant 10 years in England, and he got good transfers. Then he got obviously sold, moving from club, relegations, promotions. He's done it all, but he's scored goals wherever he's gone. So the fact that he always wanted to come home, I'm sure Tim Clancy was aware of that. I think, to be fair to me, mentioned there, the Bolton manager as well, Ian Evatt, who he had a good relationship with. He mentioned at the start when he first signed with Bolton that he had already outlined to him that if the opportunity arose to go back home, that he would want to take it up. And to be fair to Bolton, the same as though have held their part in their part of the bargain as well. So yeah, he's coming home, and I think it's a great sign, not only for Pats, but I think it's huge for the league as well, Reggie. Just when, I know we mentioned it a lot, and I know you have a keen interest in the league as well, and things are beginning to take off, hopefully, here. And obviously the addition of Damien Duff and the likes of that, and the little plots that we have now with Stephen O'Donnell, Tim Clancy, those different things, Shamrock Rovers, Jack Byrne coming back. Owen Doyle only adds to that, only enhances it really as well, Reggie, because he's a brilliant player. And they're getting him at a good time as well. It's not like he's coming back when he's finished. Mm. Like, maybe some other lads tend to do, but he's coming back when he wants to prove a point and do very well and score goals.
Yeah, and I think something that might get lost on us a little bit over here, that League One, you know, Bolton. I've been over to Bolton Wanderers, and like, the stadium is kind of out there in the middle of almost kind of out on its own. But it's a big quality stadium, really, really good setup. There's no doubt about it. Very, very good setup. And you wouldn't be, you know, you'd be kind of going, not a whole lot between some of the Premier League clubs in terms of what they have there, but just slightly off. But there's 24 teams in that league, and they're tough teams. You know, and Bolton are down, they're struggling down a little bit near the cutoff, you know. But, like, that's a tough league to play in week in, week out, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I know Doyle is hardened to those kind of seasons because he's played League One, League Two, Championship level. He knows what it's all about. And as he mentioned himself there, you're going Tuesday, Saturday, Reggie, for so much of the season. Like, it's a tough old drag, not only on the body in terms of playing the games, but the travel that's involved as well. You're going around the country, travelling around England, playing games as well. It can be tough maybe on family life also. So I know Owen's wife is a Dublin girl as well, and they were keen to come home, but it is a tough old slog, and that takes its toll on the body at some point. So the fact that he's probably reducing down the number of games as well, and I'm sure Tim will manage his game time also, but he's a fit lad, he looks after himself. But I think the fact that he'll be playing less games will only maybe prolong his career further as well, because he does look after himself, Owen Doyle, and he is in good condition.
Have you spoken to him? I know he's still playing, but, like, are there long-term ambitions around coaching, maybe getting back in here to do
it? Yeah, funny enough, Reggie, we did have that chat when he was back home, because after we did the podcast, we typically, as you do, we went for a pint afterwards. And yeah, he was basically, well, he was kind of in the unknown, because I know he has invested heavily with Danny Ventry, who used to play with Sligo, in creches here. And that was a long-term investment for him, with a view to maybe eventually when he comes back home. But he's not sure in terms of the football side of things, whether he would go down maybe the coaching route or maybe even the media route. He's well able to talk, as I say. He's a good lad as well. I think that would suit him, that kind of stuff. But it's a bit up in the air at the moment. And he signed a 3-year contract with Pat. So I think he's just concentrating on the playing side for now.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, very good. We wish him the best of luck with that. And hopefully we get to chat to him on the show soon enough as well. I'd love to get a bit more insight from him. I didn't have a bad week, actually, looking at that Arsenal team down to 10 men early on. I thought, oh my God, here we go, 3-0. My son was slagging me on the couch saying, you're done. I thought it was a great result for a young 10-man side.
Yeah, it was an absolutely brilliant result, Reggie, because the one criticism we always throw at Arsenal is that they have a soft underbelly, and games like that, they typically roll over. But to be fair to them, they knuckled down, as you say, when they were down to 10 men. I thought he made good substitutions, bringing on Holding and going 5 at the back, because, as we all know, at Liverpool, they're so reliant on Salah and Mane. So that was a plus as well for Arsenal that they weren't playing. But I thought they coped with everything that was thrown at them, and I thought they were brilliant, particularly Ben White at the back, who I think he's been a good signing, Ben White. Brilliant. But the one, as I said, the criticism that we always throw at them is that soft underbelly. But I think slowly but surely, Arteta is trying to get around that. I've been impressed with him, Reggie, since he's come in. I was unsure at the start. I think he's done okay this season. I know there's been a couple of defeats, and the Forest one was a massive blow last week. And it's just the problem with them is just when you think they're making strides and they're making progress and he's getting somewhere, they tend to let you down, and you know that as a supporter. But slowly but surely, I do think in the long term, or the bigger picture, I do think he's trying to address those issues, and I think he'll get there in the end given time, because that was a very good result for them. And it gives them a chance now going into the second leg. As I say, no Mane and no Salah against England in the game Thursday night at home in front of a bumper crowd. It gives them a huge opportunity to get to a cup final.
Yeah, were Liverpool poor though? Would that be the argument?
Yeah, you could say that as well. But and a lot of people were suggesting that, and obviously they didn't hit the heights that they normally do, Reggie. But I think you have to give credit to Arsenal, because when you go down to 10 men at Anfield as well, it's a tough place, obviously, as we know how good they are. They threw everything at them. Probably, as I said, they did miss Mane and Salah, as most teams would, and they are maybe a bit reliant on them. And it's only when you see those two not playing that you can see just how reliant they are. But to be fair, I would give a lot of credit to Arsenal. I thought they played very, very well defensively. They were well organised, well structured. The substitutions that he made, as I say, bringing on Holding and going with 5 at the back. And people might think that was an obvious substitution to make. Maybe it was, but I thought they played very, very well, to be fair, to hold out for the nil-all.
Okay, very good. There's a very interesting article in today's Irish Independent by Jamie Carragher, and he's not holding back, you know. So basically the headline is, United's flat, feckless squad are hard to like. Club's decline is on them. Ralph Ranieri's team remind me of our Liverpool side under Roy Hodgson. No passion, no emotion, no enjoyment. You know, like I said, he's not holding back. And I don't think there's too many that will disagree with him.
No, well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with him. I think Carragher's the best pundit out there, and it's blindingly obvious, Reggie. Like, we're looking at Man United over the past two or three seasons now, and I don't think it's just a case of what, since Ragnick has come in, that obviously we've seen a couple of poor performances. This has been all season, but I think this has manifested itself under Solskjaer as well. I would apportion a fair bit of the blame to him as well, because even though the players are letting themselves down massively, and I'd have huge criticisms of the players, I think he let them away with so much for so long. And all we used to hear after every match or press conference, regardless of the result, was, oh, they're a great group of lads and they're really trying under this, that and the other. But they're not a good group of lads, Reggie. That's been borne out now. We're looking at them. Their attitude is poor. And you know as yourself, in playing games, Reggie, you can have an off day. Anyone can have an off day, and for whatever reason, and it just might not, things not, you might not get the break of the ball or whatever, but you should always have the right attitude. And that can happen the odd day when you maybe don't. But when that's happening continuously over a period of time, week after week, we're seeing it now for months and months with these players. And I think, as I say, it's been manifested for a long time under Solskjaer, because he never nailed them or he never really held them accountable the way he should have. Whereas now you're seeing the culture that's there, and it's very, very hard to break that culture, because I think it's gone. It's toxic at this stage, that culture, with a lot of those players. And Carragher, as I said, has been critical in that article, but that's been borne out for me over a long period of time, and we're seeing the result of it now. Unfortunately for Ragnick, he's having to pick up the pieces, and it's difficult for him coming in. But I think they needed a manager to come in to maybe shake them up and give them a kick up the arse. Mm. And I don't think he's going to be the manager to do that, Reggie, at all.
Yeah, and like, they have a very tough task ahead of them tonight. Like, I mean, they're going away to Villa. You've got Gerrard, who's probably going to get Coutinho on the pitch for his first game tonight, looking to get a good performance out of him and get the crowd behind them early. And I genuinely think they could rattle. I've watched that Villa side playing quite a bit, and they're a tough side. They're very hard to break down. They're a very, very tough side. And you're bringing in Coutinho into that. You've got Stevie Gerrard there, who's kind of instilling a bit of confidence in that side. And United are coming here in a bit of a shambles. I fancy Villa for that one.
Yeah, I would as well. And that's the thing as well with United. That era of invincibility is gone, Reggie. Everyone fancies their chances against Man United now. Like, we remember the days growing up when under Ferguson and teams were beaten in the tunnel. You'd always hear that famous phrase, the teams were beaten before they even went on the pitch. Whereas all that is gone now. Every team that plays Man United fancied their chances. Norwich outplayed them only a few weeks ago. Newcastle, who were absolutely desperate and fighting relegation, should have beat them. Villa at the start of the season earlier on as well should have beat them. You look at Villa in the cup game Monday night, absolutely destroyed them as well, and Gerrard would be devastated that they didn't get through the cup tie, because they were the better team the other night. So absolutely they'll fancy their chances tonight, and I would fancy Villa as well, Reggie. I think Villa are a good side. For the first thing, the only thing I would throw in, though, for the first time since Gerrard has come back down, and I think he's done a really good job, and I really like the look of Gerrard as a manager. He won 4 of his first 6, and the 2 that he lost was Liverpool and Man City, who you'd expect them to maybe lose against. That's fair enough. But their last 3 matches, they've lost 2 in the league and obviously United in the cup. So maybe for the first time, he's on the back foot a little bit. I know it's only a short window in terms of 10-11 games, but for the first time, I think he's just on the back foot that he's lost the last 3 games. So he'll be expecting a big response from his players, and he'll want one himself, because he knows he'll probably need a result. So I would fancy Villa strongly against United tonight.
Yeah, okay. We'll keep an eye on that one. Now, the other one, obviously the juicy one I'm looking forward to is the Spurs-Arsenal game. That's going to be an absolute cracker. 5th versus 6th. I see Conte is kind of not giving any guarantees about his future. He's been kind of tight-lipped around the transfer window time.
Yeah, because I think Conte now is realising, and he probably should have realised the problems that were there at Spurs before he even went in, Reggie. That's a massive job. Like, we speak about what United have to do in terms of maybe offloading players and changing a culture. It's something similar at Spurs, because there's so many players there just not good enough. And I think he's realising that now. He's actually done really well in the short space of time that he's gone in with what he has. But I think if you look at the last 2 games, particularly those Carabao Cup semi-finals where Chelsea totally outplayed them and they were dominant in the 2 games, I think he realises now just the job that he has in hand, and in terms of maybe what he needs to do in the transfer window. I think as well, you probably saw that with him playing the goalkeeper Galina instead of Lloris. I think that was a message to Levy saying, look, we need players here. And I'm sure he probably sought out those assurances before he came into the job, Reggie, because there's no way he would have been looking at that from the outside thinking, oh, I'm taking over a really good group of players. There's some players there that are just not good enough, and he would have known that he would have needed to bring in players. So I'm sure he sought out that at the start of his managerial time at Spurs, and I'm sure Levy probably gave him those assurances. So it's up to Levy now to maybe put his hand in his pocket and bring in the players players that Conte needs, because he's a brilliant manager, Reggie. I think United should have went for Conte, and I think that's the mistake they made with what was available. Well, possibly, as you say there, because he's not really committing too much. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I'm looking at Man United now, who we all think is the biggest club in the world. I would go and get Conte now. And I know Ragnick has said he's come in for a short period of time.
Put him upstairs, maybe, and put Conte down below.
Yeah, something like that, because that would be the arrangement I would look for, because I think he's a brilliant manager and he's certainly one that would shake things up at United.
No question about it. Okay, the biggest one of the day, 12:30 today, City taking on Chelsea, first versus second. The only thing is, City are kind of struggling with coronavirus patients. We don't know yet who their team is going to be. They're not releasing the ones that are fully affected, but certainly last week, Ederson, Sterling, Foden, they were all dodgy, you know, so it might not be the City that we've come to expect.
No, it'll be interesting to see exactly, as you say, the lineup, because Chelsea have already been affected by their COVID period, and Liverpool, and it's probably scuppered the league race, really, Reggie, because I've spoken so many times to you every week about thinking that this will be the best title race we've ever seen, but it looks like it probably won't be now, because obviously Liverpool have had a major blip, and as I say, with the COVID stuff, Chelsea too, whereas Man City haven't had that, and this is the first period now where they might have it. If any team can cope with it and a squad can cope with it, it's probably Man City, because of the quality that they have, but it will be interesting to see just who's injured. But I think it just goes to show the quality that Man City have, that we're calling Chelsea's blip. And it was a blip, really, because they've had four draws out of six matches. But it just goes to show that you can't even afford to have the odd draw. And one of those was against Liverpool, where they drew 2-2. Whereas on paper, you'd look at that and think, OK, one of our nearest rivals, it's not a bad result. But because City's form is so good and they're relentless and just keep winning match after match, even those draws look like nearly defeats at this stage. And that's why they've gone so far behind in the table. And unfortunately for us, I don't think we'll get the race now that we wanted, Reggie.
Yeah, we'll see. But
unless Chelsea win today, like Chelsea. Yeah. And they have obviously picked up the last couple of weeks. They seem as though they've got back on the horse and they've won, they beat Spurs comprehensively in those semi-finals. So I would love to see, maybe from the neutral point of view, Chelsea beating Man City today, bringing it back to 7 points, and all of a sudden, maybe we think we have a race back on.
Yeah, I think so too. I actually think they have a great chance with so many players doubtful, and then maybe just coming back after COVID, and maybe they're not quite up to form, and all that kind of stuff. I think Chelsea have a good chance in that one, and I kind of like to see it just for the league. Mm. Yeah, so we'll see. Okay, you'll be podcasting again soon, won't you?
Yeah, we'll be back in February, Reggie, so we're looking forward to obviously to getting back and the league starting back. As I say, there's huge excitement around what's going on currently at the moment in the league, and season tickets have been selling great.
Is it
the 19th of February, yeah. Okay, yeah, so not long now, not long.
GAA with Declan Drake on Dublin's Talking Sport.
We start this morning with football and the fact Dublin won their two Auburn Cup games played in the space of 5 days over the last week. Desi Farrell, practising the mix of experienced All-Ireland winners and young, keen talent, oversaw victories over Offaly and most recently Louth in Parnell Park midweek under the lights. Lorcan O'Dell was one of the three goal scorers in that Louth game, Cormac Costello with the other two. Today, the Blues are on the road again in the competition. This time, it takes them to Longford, where they will face the home team in the Midlands with a 2 o'clock start. On the club front, we say congratulations to Kilmacud Crokes, who last week for the fifth time in their history won the Leinster Club Football Championship. A double scores win over Naas, 14-7. The purple and gold minus Paul Mannion, keeping the Kildare champions scoreless in the second half. Afterwards, in the Hogan stand, I spoke to Crokes boss Robbie Brennan. He began by expressing his satisfaction with the win and then spoke about the loss of key man Mannion through injury. Robbie Brennan, Bannisdore, Kilmacud Crokes, champions of Leinster. Robbie, that's a sweet sound on this bitterly cold Saturday evening.
Yeah, it's a nice phrase to it, all right, Deg. I think the last time Leinster final, we were just as cold in Tullamore. I think you were chatting to me then, so it's nice to come out the right side of it, yeah.
No Paul Mannion.
We gave him every opportunity to try and get there, and Paul wanted to do that himself, and just ran out of time, unfortunately, so he didn't make it. He was trying, to be fair to him, God, he's some man. He was trying every little bit he could, whether it was strapping and looking at injections and everything else, and then it just wasn't going to happen. So he went in, and they decided, no, he'd need to get a little minor op done on it, so he's managed to get that done and out of the way now.
Once again, well done to all at Kilmacud Crokes from us here on Dublin's Talking Sport on that championship success last week. Next up for them, by the way, is the All-Ireland semi-final against Pádraig Pearse's of Roscommon. That one scheduled for 2 weeks' time. Finally, in football, to the ladies' game, and congratulations to our county and provincial champions, St Jude's at junior level and St Sylvester's at intermediate level, who last weekend qualified for the semi-finals of the go-ahead current account.ie All-Ireland Series. Well done to both of them, with tremendous victories over British opposition last Saturday and Sunday. To hurling now, and the Walsh Cup, which is of course the traditional pre-season competition in Leinster. Dublin opened their campaign with a Parnell Park victory over Antrim last Sunday, and they're back at county headquarters tomorrow afternoon when they face Galway from 2 o'clock. Well, quite a lot of water has gone under the proverbial bridge since we played Galway last. That was in the Leinster semi-final last summer, and of course we won. King Henry Shefflin since of course has become manager of the Tribesmen, while Matty Kenny has stayed on as Dublin boss for a fourth year. Joining me now is our regular hurling analyst, Sean Lane. Delighted to welcome you back to the programme. And first of all, Happy New Year to you, Sean.
Many happy returns, Declan, and delighted to be here.
Yeah, fantastic to have you back on board again this season. As you say, started off with the victory over Antrim last week. Galway opened up with a victory over Offaly. So going into tomorrow's game at the Nell, both teams have good confidence coming into it. What did you make of the victory over Antrim from a Dublin perspective last week, Sean?
Yeah, I suppose, Declan, it was your typical first match of the season. Dublin trotted out in the park and looked good and got a couple of scores, but fell asleep then for 10 or 12 minutes, and I think Antrim rallied on about 1-7, which you know, didn't look great at the time. But I have to give them great credit. They rallied and got a... Colin Curry got a great goal before half time as well, and found themselves a few points up. But overall, Declan, they scored 227, conceded 121, which is probably a bit high, but 227. Matty's never had many issues with getting good big scores up. What I liked about what I saw was he tried. He obviously did, and we said, and you asked me, would he try new players? He definitely brought in Colin Curry. He got 113. I think there was 1-4 from play. Alex Considine, they're two people that showed great form in the club championship. He then had Shane Barrett and Eamon Dillon back, which is and also a plus, and Tom Connolly came in as a sub. So he certainly has brought in a few young people. He's gone looking back to people that were there or thereabouts. He's given them a turn again, and he has a few that always performed. Paddy Smith was excellent again at fullback, and Rian McBride threw over 5 points. So all in all, Declan, Matty would be happy with the outcome. It was a first match. But, you know, it was Antrim, and Sunday's game is a little bit to step up. And as you talk about, King Henry will be in Parnell Park. I hope every young lad will go over and watch the game.
Such a circus surrounded them last week. I think people were queuing from 11 o'clock in the morning to get into the game in Ballinasloe, which didn't start till 2 o'clock. Hopefully, as you say, there will be a big crowd in Parnell Park tomorrow afternoon supporting Dublin. But this has a similar pattern to last year, Sean, in the sense that we played Antrim in the first round of the Championship, beat them. Then we played Galway and, of course, beat them in Croke Park. Now, the question this week is, can we beat them in our second Walsh Cup game tomorrow afternoon?
Well, I suppose the answer to that is yes, we can. You know, is it a big game? It's a big game from lots of perspectives. From a Galway perspective, and let's talk about that quickly. Henry is there. He's lit a fire under Galway hurling. The crowds are back. He's a brand new, young side. No one has as much experience in this day and age as Henry Shefflin. 10 All-Ireland medals. He'll bring great passion to them. He'll inculcate them with desire and the will to win and all of that, and his experience. They'll be a formidable team. They had, as you said, a very, very good win the first day against Offaly. He had Michael Fennelly on the line against them, two great Kilkenny stalwarts. But, you know, this Dublin team, you know, let's see, it is a second day out. We'll have Galway and then we'll have Offaly. You know, I think if we can improve slightly on the last day, the home advantage, plus a lot of the Galway experienced players aren't in the lineup, I think we have a good chance of beating them, Declan, yeah.
You touched on it yourself there earlier, Sean, about the new players that were brought in, and that was an important thing to learn from the Championship. And there were so many positive examples from three or four different clubs that Matty has picked up on and is affording these people the opportunity, which is, of course, what this competition is all about.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, you asked me there the last day about what's his job. And his job is to get all of the best players that he can, add them onto the ones that he has, And I think Matty is doing the right thing and will do the right thing over the three games. He'll probably have to drop three or four from last year's panel. We talked about the under-20s getting to an All-Ireland final. I still believe there's one or two there, particularly in the Crokes set up. Paddy Lenehan and Dara Purcell, I think they're involved with the Crokes footballers at the moment. So there's another two that he has to have a look at and try and get into the senior squad. So, you know, he has to bring Newlong as. But what I do like about him is, you know, particularly the Tom Connolly, Shane Barrett and Eamon Dillon, he's not discarding anybody either. He's given these guys a chance as well. And to be fair to him, you know, I'd say Matty has his three-game plan. I'm going to look at everybody. The results are probably irrelevant. Matty wants to get his team right for the National League and ultimately have it right for, which I'm delighted with. We're back to the round-robin championship match where we have five games again this year. Kilkenny at home. I think you alluded to it a few times. It's a game a couple of years ago we should have won in Parnell Park. But, you know, it's great to be looking forward to the summer again. They're the key matches. But I think Matty's going the right way about it, and I'll be very interested to see how they get on.
Overall, I agree. It's great to have the games to look forward to, all right. But there's something about the cut and thrust of straightforward knockout hurling as well, like what it was last year. I mean, we had to beat Antrim. It was as simple as that. It was do or die on the day. We did, and we took it off from there. Now, one decision that Matty has made and became public after the game last Sunday was his announcement as captain. Owen O'Donnell of Whitehall Column Kills, the fullback, is the new Dublin captain for 2022, ably assisted by Keane O'Callaghan, of course, of Coola. To me, in my mind, looking at it, they are two good choices. Do you think he made those choices?
Well, I'd say that the captaincy one, if you just take Owen O'Donnell, this time last year before, you might recall, he got injured during the Leinster final against Kilkenny. But prior to that, in all the National League games, you know, top hurling people on the Sunday game, etc., they were basically telling us, and rightly so, I believe, that he was one of the best fullbacks in the country at the time. And that was, you know, Conor Prunty, Doughy Bourke, Dan Morrissey. They were putting him in that bracket, and I believe he should be. I think he instills lots of confidence in the full-back line. I think he's an exceptionally good reader of the game. He's very clever in possession when he discards it and looks up. But also, he lifts a crowd, and he's very, very fast. So I think it's a very, very good pick in relation to the captain. I don't know what he's like in the dressing room, but having said all that, I mean, having that kind of capability and competency that he shows on the field, I'm quite sure he'll have what's required inside in the dressing room. Interesting then, the vice-captain, a cooler man, Keane O'Callaghan, and I would be very friendly with his dad and played with him a few times. I think Keane is a born leader. If you go back, Keane was the captain of the Dublin minor team that went to the All-Ireland final. I think it was the 2011 team, beat Kilkenny and went on to the final. But what I liked about Keane was that the two All-Ireland club finals, particularly the Napiership one that went to a replay, that when Coola, I thought, had the game won, they fell behind with a couple of scores to the Napiership, and Coola lads had to stand up with 7 or 8 minutes ago, and no better man than Keane himself. The two or three balls that went into him, there was one brilliant passage of play where he caught a ball, came out, threw lads off and lashed the ball as far away as he could. His brother caught it down the other end, Con rounded and stuck the ball over the bar, and Coola won the match. So I think they're a very, very good choice, both of them, by Matty, and I'm just looking forward to the whole season, Declan, at this stage.
Time to turn our attention to rugby now. Delighted to be joined by Will Slattery of the Irish Independent and, of course, the Left Wing podcast. Good morning, Will. Great to talk to you.
Hi, Reggie. How are things?
Things are great, thank you. Nice weekend of Champions Cup rugby, so I'm looking forward to it. But before we get into that, I read the article by Rory this morning about Leo Cullen lashing out at the EPRC, is the way it's described, over the illogical approach. Some, you know, would turn around and say, well, you get on with it and sour grapes and all the rest of it. But there's a hell of a lot of logic to what Leo Cullen is saying, and not very much logic to what the EPCR seem to be doing in terms of this decision. Goes back to the Montpellier decision to award a 28-0 win to them and the 5 points, of course, at a time when Leinster were ready to travel. I don't think we've heard the end of this yet, have we?
Well, yes and no. Like, I think it will be brought up and spoken about, especially if Leinster go on and end up getting difficult draws or away from home draws that they probably wouldn't have gotten or might not have gotten had they been allowed to fulfil the fixture. But at the same time, and I think Leo might have mentioned it yesterday, they've no real recourse to appeal. There's no real structure in place for them to go to a higher body. Like, you know, I don't think they're going to go to like the Court for Arbitration for Sport in like Belgium or somewhere to try to get the game played. So they don't really have that much wiggle room to get the game played. There's no free weekends now that the EPCR have opted to do 0-0 draws for the other games. It's immensely frustrating for Leinster, and you know, as referred to, you know, by Leo yesterday and by Rory in that article, there's obviously the home advantage potential if you keep progressing to the tournament, if you get a top seeding. But there's also the financial aspect of it. You know, Leinster could have potentially had, you know, a home quarter, a home semi if they'd progressed. That's huge money spinners at the Aviva Stadium. Two full houses, you know, presuming crowds will be allowed. After the year we've had, or the 2 years we've had, that's huge for Ireland rugby, for Leinster rugby, to be able to keep players at home, to be able to maybe attract one marquee signing. So, yeah, it has massive repercussions. And they won't be very happy if they go on and if they get lumped with a very difficult away draw where you would have fancied them to get the victory over Montpellier. So, yeah, it's an interesting situation. And Leo Cullen doesn't often come out and blast the way he did yesterday. So it really shows how frustrated they are in Leinster. And I suspect they'll take it out on a pretty weak in Montpellier on Sunday.
Yeah, and I know I met with a number of Leinster officials before Christmas there. This, it's not before the Bath game. And that was the topic of conversation. Like the money involved is the real crux of this. It's not anything else, you know. They really need that home draw and the benefits that they gain from that, especially in a COVID hit financially strapped time. I know what you're saying about no recourse. I'd be surprised. I'd say there's a few legal eagles looking at this and seeing if there's any sort of comeback on this, because, you know, this isn't the old days where the governing body made a decision and get on with it. Like, this is high end sport with a lot of money at stake, and there might well be more to it, you know.
Yeah, there's no real window to play the game is the only thing, because even, you know, during the Six Nations, Montpellier have top 14 games that are being rescheduled. I don't know if Montpellier...
But even on that, though, will rescheduling the game, leave that aside. They've made a decision to offer 2 points for a draw to other games in similar situations. That 2 points could be crucial for getting your home draw. It's all about the points basis.
No, true. I suppose, yeah, the EPCR are putting forward that, you know, the two-point mechanism that decided certain games didn't apply for the Leinster fixture, you know... After consulting with their medical council, you know, that's what they came to their conclusion. It would be very hard. I would have thought for Leinster to kind of produce evidence to overturn a council of five doctors, one of whom is actually, I think, on the IRFU panel as well. So I actually think they're going to be stuck with that 5 point, you know, the 5-0 to Montpellier. Yeah, I don't see them getting around from that.
Yeah, well, I know just from talking to fans and supporters, they cannot work it out. It's completely illogical. And what you're saying, I get entirely. But again, when you're on the outside looking in, you're trying to work it out as a Leinster supporter. Hang on. There was, you know, there was 17 lads who supposedly had COVID in one of the other games. I can't remember which one. Then you had the Munster Wasps game where both sets of squads were. We're kind of down with COVID, and it was changed because of that. So, but they still were able to play the game. And then you've got last night, where even last night in the game for Munster, there were supposed to be six players on that caster side who had COVID. Yet the game went ahead. So there's no logic to any of it. If you're kind of going, well, why did they go ahead and these didn't?
Be rescheduled. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Like, it is a really strange time, and even the decision to give the 0-0 draws kind of went, people thought they would be rescheduled for later on, and the last 16 could be moved to one leg. So it's really up in the air at the moment. I just feel with every other game now decided, I'd be very surprised if there was any movement on the Leinster one.
Yeah, they can't be seen to lose face either. Let's move on. Okay, what a great victory that was last night for Munster. I won't say it was a great game, because it certainly wasn't a whole lot to enjoy in that, other than the victory, but it was great guts to keep going right to the very end, and literally was the very end, and snatch that victory.
Yeah, it's funny, like Harlequins Cardiff was on at the same time on another channel, and I was kind of jealous of the people who were maybe watching that, because obviously, you know, as with the Irish interest, I was watching Munster Cast, but as you say, wasn't a great game. Kind of similar to the Ulster game, I would give Munster a lot of credit for battling back and for rescuing a victory at the end, but as you say there, the points are the most important thing, because, you know, talking about seedings and whatnot, Munster are now 3-3. They're just behind Harlequins in that table. They could potentially overtake them with a bonus point victory against Wasps. But either way, they're well set up for a tilt at the knockout stages. But performance-wise, I'd still be pretty disappointed from a Munster perspective. Like, interesting, just reading the quotes from Johan van Graan today. He was saying he thought it was... I asked for an 80-minute performance. We certainly got that. Like, I don't really agree with that. I thought they were pretty wasteful in the cast 22. They made very hard work of that victory. They shouldn't have been relying on a 78-minute try to get that win. They had, I think, 3 or 4 5-metre lineouts. They lost them all. You know, there was a couple of drop passes. Like, you know, Craig Casey was freed by a nice offload by Chris Farr with a couple of minutes to go right under the post. He fumbled that ball. On occasion, they did try to play a bit of rugby, but just the skill level and the execution was just a long way off. They're going to have to be a lot better. You know, I feel kind of mean in a way, kind of raining on the parade, but at the same time, you know, they haven't won a trophy since 2011. That's how they're being judged. That's how they want to be judged. So you have to be, you know, pretty honest and objective when you're looking at this. And while the win was great and it showed great spirit and character, that's never been in question. I still thought the performance level wasn't great, considering Cass, I think, made 13 changes from their last victory because they were focusing on the league. So it's not as if they were up against a full-strength Cass side either. So overall, I suppose it's a positive result, but still a lot of room for improvement, I think.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You don't want to feel like you're bashing in any way, but that wasn't exactly a red-hot Caster side last night, and you would have thought that Munster would put them away more comfortably. So I see what you're saying. When they get to the more difficult stages of this competition, which they will, it looks like, you know, they'd need to improve a lot. Was it Nicosi that rang it over Conway last night?
Murray and Nicosi, Murray, too, yeah. Unbelievable. They were Jonah. It was like Jonah Lomu and Mike Cass back in, back in 1995. Just trucked over them. It was actually unbelievable. But it's good. He was one of the few regulars that they kept in situ. And to be fair to him, he actually had a very good game. Just to give Munster a bit of credit and give some positive praise to some of the players who really stood up. John Hodnett, again, I thought off the bench, really added a lot of impetus when he came in. I was disappointed not to see him get the start. They went with O'Mahony, Jack O'Donoghue and Gavin Coombs. Fair enough, that's a settled back row. But Hodnett was unbelievable against Wasps and that kind of, you know, patchwork team after being out for a long period with an Achilles tendon tear. He was on that Ireland Grand Slam winning Six Nations team a couple of years ago, and he was a huge prospect. I'd love to see him get a bit more chance. And again, Tadhg Byrne, yeah, didn't have his best game. He did give away a couple of uncharacteristic penalties, but he came up with that key turnover at the end where it was an unbelievable show of strength over the ball. There was like three lads hammering away at him at the breakdown. He's been so good for them. And I was saying this to someone else recently, I just don't feel like he's gotten his rewards over the last year and a half for what I think has been a stellar run of form. Like, Warren Gatland criminally underused him on the Lions series. Yeah. He got, I think, 6 or 7 minutes in the first test and about 10 in the second, was dropped for the third. And then even he started against Japan, Ireland played really well, and then he was put to the bench against New Zealand, even though I understand maybe they wanted a bit more beef in the pack. But he was really good. He got the key turnover at the end of that game as well.
Yeah,
he's just such a good player. And I'd like to see him get a little more recognition, I feel, because I not from the fans, because I think everyone praises him a lot, but from the coach. I feel like there's something maybe holding him back a little bit. I'm not quite sure from the outside what that is.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt he's the form player at the moment in all of the provinces. I'd agree with you entirely on that, yeah. Fair play to Andrew Conway, though. I mean, Murray was a little bit off balance when he went in to make that tackle, but when he got up, it was the shot of the night for me. When he got up and he just looked around and shook his head a little bit and kind of went, "Jeez, what was that? Where did that come from?" So it was brilliant. Fair play to him, getting back up and getting back into the game. Okay, Connacht have got Leicester. A big challenge. Like, oh God, back in the day when I was playing against Leicester, you'd be terrified, absolutely terrified about playing Leicester at any stage in any competition. And if you beat them, it was a huge, huge victory. But Connacht down in the sports ground against this Leicester side, I fancy them.
Yeah, so do I, especially when I saw the team sheet that Leicester have put out. They've rested quite a few guys, like George Ford, Ben Youngs, Nemanja Nadolo, Dan Kelly, their top centres on the bench, and even in the pack, you know, George Martin isn't playing. They still have some very, you know, top players like Ellis Genge is there, Jasper Visa at number 8, one of their Springboks guys, Freddie Stewart, England international in the back three. But they have definitely taken a view that, you know, with 2 wins from 2, they're not going all guns blazing. I think they want to put their flag back on the Premiership and kind of reassert their position in English rugby. And obviously, to be fair to them, they went away to Bordeaux with a similar team selection in week one and got the victory. So that's not to say that they're not very dangerous today, but I just feel like Connacht are in a good place at the moment. There's just a lot of positivity around them. They have their, you know, Jack Carty's back, Bundy Aki's there. They have, like, close to their full-strength team. I actually think it's set up well for them. And then, funnily enough, you know, they go to Stade Français potentially next weekend, a team who we don't know what they might have to play for. Connacht could end up getting, you know, a good seeding if things go well for them. This is a massive game for them. Like, beating Stade in the first weekend, that was quite expected. Stade had a very weakened team. This is the form team in Europe at the moment. To get a victory here would just really copper fasten the progress Andy Friend has been making. Like, you can't get much more positivity from what's being said about the setup. But then to take a big scalp like this in Europe and basically have one foot in the knockout stages, if they wouldn't already be qualified for the first time ever for Connacht, would be huge.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, Ulster are away to Northampton, aren't they? Yeah, and that's a huge game for them as well. And Ulster, I'm still not convinced about Ulster, and, you know, I think I wouldn't be alone in that. It just seems to be inconsistent is the word I'll still use for them with their performances. You just kind of don't really know what you're going to get. Brilliant one minute, and then lackluster the next.
Yeah, I think I referred to it on the show before, but Dan McFarland gave a pretty interesting press conference after the defeat to Ospreys earlier in the season, where he said he just couldn't understand how when they're favoured, they just really never deliver, and when they're underdogs, they seem to really get up. To be fair, that's true of a lot of teams, but if you even look at the Munster match, they came in as slight underdogs. They started really, really well. Zeebo gets sent off, and Ulster are already 7-0 up. They're massive favourites then, and they just don't deliver anything for the rest of the game. They score 6 points against 14 men over an hour. They scored 7 against 15 in 20 minutes. The game management was very poor, even like Nathan Doak taking on a Hail Mary penalty from the halfway line, touchline, when if you put that into the corner, you bleed the clock, you might win another penalty with a couple of minutes to go. Stuff like that just would be tearing your hair out if Dan McFarlane had any, I suppose. And this Northampton game is an interesting one. Like, Northampton have picked, you know, their full-strength team. Courtney Laws is back. Dan Biggar is playing. So even though they've lost 2 from 2, they're still, you know, one victory in this format or even one victory and a few bonus points could be enough to get you into the last 16 and get a lucrative home last 16 tie. So Northampton are really going for it. John Cooney is a very big loss. He's kind of found some form again. McCluskey's kind of a medium-term injury as well. James Hume is back, which is a good boost. But I think Ulster might struggle in this one. I wouldn't be surprised if Northampton got the win.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. And it's an interesting point you make there about the new format. It feels slightly easier this year for me to just qualify for that last 16. Yeah, like you said, get a couple of run of games behind your belt and all of a sudden you're up above that danger line. It just feels easier.
Yeah, and it depends what pool you are in as well. I think if memory serves, Connacht's pool might be slightly... I don't have it down, but yeah, one of the pools is slightly easier as well. It was a run of fixtures. And it also depends on who was affected by those nil-nil draws as well. Like, for instance, Toulouse were a team who would have definitely probably got 5 points. They ended up with 2. La Rochelle, similarly. So that could throw up some interesting seeding matchups in the last 16 as well. You could have, you know, a couple of heavyweight ties because people are maybe seeded slightly differently. But yeah, I suppose I think the way they've structured it this year is to get more teams into the tournament, given the COVID nature of it and leagues being disrupted. And then also to kind of gear it towards the knockout stages. 16 teams going into the knockouts. It worked really well last year in terms of drama, to be fair, because as much as the pool stage, the traditional 6 teams back-to-backs were very engaging a lot of the times, you can't beat knockout rugby as well. Like, knockout rugby is really where things really ratchet up again. It worked well last year, and the two legs, I'm really glad they salvaged that in the end and gave the nil-nil draws, because we haven't really done that in rugby before. That's like one of the things rugby has never really gone towards, other than maybe the championship in England. The second tier used to do a two-leg final. So even the mentality of what that'll be like, you know, from watching the Champions League, how the away leg, you might try to get out of there with a narrow loss to go back home. Even things like that will be very fascinating to watch. So yeah, I get your point that it's a bit easier to qualify, but I think come knockout stages, we mightn't be complaining too much if we get some tasty ties.
Turn our attention to the NFL now. We're getting down to the business end of things, and I'm delighted to be joined by the great Stephen O'Brien. How are you, Stephen? Are you well?
What an intro. Reggie, I'm good. How are you?
Very well indeed. It's, like I said, the business time of the year. People were worried that this season, you know, extending it a little bit would be a kind of a boring snooze fest, but they were wrong. The games were epic.
Yeah, because this is the thing, you extend the season and then what ends up happening, Reg, this is what they were worried about, is that, you know, they would have locked up their playoff spot. No one cares. They put their second, third stringers out there, you know, and it's just a bit of a waffly game. It wasn't that case at all, because there were some teams, we talked about them last week, you win, you're in, happy days. And then we looked at the likes of, you know, the Indianapolis Colts. They're winning the end. They're coming up against the Jacksonville Jags. You put a wager on that every day of the week, Reg, but they lost 26-11 to the worst team in the NFL. So after that game happened, it kind of just blew open an awful lot of sort of opportunities for other teams. And then some of the other teams, Reg, the ones that kind of mattered all went into overtime. There was like drama about, like, you know, for instance, the best one of the weekend, and I've never seen this happen before, came down to the Raiders and the Chargers. So all of these teams, all they needed to do, and this would have knocked the Steelers out, because the Steelers kind of, you know, this is Big Ben. He's retiring, right? He's been retiring now for the last 10 years. We spoke about him nearly every year now where he says, I'm hanging up the boots. So he goes and wins against the Ravens in a really poo-poo kind of game. I mean, it was awful. If you look at him, just dreadful stuff. But he wins, and they're like, going, oh, you know, the Raiders and Chargers, then it's all eyes on this game. And then it goes in, and there was sort of talk about that. Look, all of these teams in this game needed to do was tie. And they don't like that in America. It's not like soccer over here. But as the game went on, Reg, it was looking more likely that they actually were going to tie. And if that game went into a tie, both of the teams would have went into the playoffs. So as it started to sort of grind down, the game went into overtime. Herbert came back from just a ridiculous deficit for the Chargers and looks like a world beater. He had so many fourth down completions, which is bonkers. So it goes into overtime. It gets down to below 1 minute of play. It's still tied, and it's in both teams' best interest to just tie the game up. And inexplicably, the Chargers coach calls a timeout, which stops the clock. And then that ends up, the Raiders go down to kick a field goal and win the game. Now, people are like, well, why did that happen? Well, the Raiders want to win the game because it changes their seeding, let's say. But again, kicking that field goal at the end, Reg, was risky, because if that got blocked and ran back, then they were out of the playoffs. So wow. Loads of teams had something to lose. But after the game, the players, you could see them meeting and people are lips reading and lip syncing and everything else. And you can see the players say to each other, oh, we were playing for the tie until that timeout. So until the timeout, in less than a minute, dumped the Chargers out of the playoffs. An absolute, the most dramatic tie in NFL history it would have been. But that's how it ended up. But just an incredible last week to the NFL.
Incredible is right. That's what you want. And of course, that Monday, usually after the final weekend, is when we see all of the mass sackings. There were a few coaches their heads were on the chopping block.
Yeah, we spoke about them a bit, didn't we, Reg, where, you know, you look at these coaches and they're dead men walking. They've lost all respect. You know, there's a couple of games left in the season, and it's just that a sort of respect that they don't let them go at that stage. That kind of happened with Matt Nagy with the Bears. But as you say, they call it Black Monday because it's literally the Sunday. They don't wait around. They don't sort of, you know, have a sort of sit down and have a chat about it. The minute that Sunday ends, they're literally packing the stuff in the brown boxes and leaving the building. That's it. They're done. So that happened with the Broncos, Vic Fangio. Here's a guy who's sort of, you know, massive defensive mind. They sacked him. That was kind of expected. Matt Nagy for the Bears, he's out. Mike Zimmer, kind of an old timer, he's been in Minnesota for forever. They sacked him. Joe Judge, apparently he got sacked by the Giants. He held a massive party after he got sacked. That's how happy he was. The kind of shock there is Brian Flores for the Dolphins. They sacked him. You know, they started the season 1-7, they ended 9-8. They were still in with a shout at the playoffs late. So people are sort of scratching their heads there. But the rumors came out then that he wasn't getting along with people in the building. So the minute just, you know, you don't get on with your boss, you know, it's a no-brainer that you end up going. But yeah, another grim day for the coaches around the NFL, looking for new jobs coming into this season.
Well, I'm sure they'll find something. But the playoffs are finally here. So quickly, just give us an idea how they work, and then the games themselves and who's playing and what to look out for.
Yeah, so the playoffs, this is the Champions League of NFL. So, you know, if you have Sky Sports, by all means, go and give it a view, because these are the creme de la creme of teams that get in. Particularly in this round that comes up, Reds, there are some teams that squeak in. They call it Super Wildcard Weekend, sort of expanded the amount of teams that can get in. So, like, last year was atrocious for this, but this year is actually quite good. Some good matchups. Basically, you lose this match that you play in, you're out. The Packers aren't playing. In the AFC, the Tennessee, there's one team that sort of get the seed, so they're not playing. So the best team will face the worst team in the next round. And they've played games on a Saturday this time round. And there's some clanger of games that are happening as well. So you have this game, and then the next game is called the divisional round. Then you go to the championship. It's effectively the semi-finals, and then it's the Super Bowl.
So there's, you know, there's only three games or so left to actually decide all this thing. AFC, Las Vegas versus Cincinnati. Cincinnati beat Las Vegas the last time. They're the favourites, so that's why they're in Miami. New England, you know, he's after finding his way in again, Bill Belichick. They go up against the Buffalo Bills. They traded wins during the season, but Buffalo had the last laugh, so Buffalo would expect to go there. Pittsburgh, Big Ben should be sent into retirement against the Kansas City Chiefs this weekend. They're the number 7 seed, and Kansas are firing on all cylinders, so they should put them to bed. The NFC, Reg, Arizona, LA, that's going to be a great game. San Francisco against Dallas, another good game. And then Philadelphia versus the Tampa Bay Bucks. The Tampa Bay Bucks are expected to win that. But look, there's always upsets when it comes to you know, away teams in the playoffs. The thing about the playoffs is that the teams aren't worried about who they're going to face next. All eyes are on this game, and if they get through this, then they just face whoever. So it's not like the regular season where, you know, they think, oh, if we win this game or if we lose this game, it's fine because you've got four more games against easy opponents. This is it now. This is the knockout stage of the World Cup type stuff. So it's going to be super exciting. So again, we won't see Green Bay and Tennessee until next week. Yeah. And then after that, then it's the semifinals and then the Super Bowl. But yeah, look, cracking football for, you know, all the way to the Super Bowl from here on out.
Thanks for listening to Dublin Stock and Sport on Sunshine 106.8 from myself, Ken and Reggie. Have a good weekend.